So what I'd like us to do is turn over to the 12th chapter of Genesis. And while we're not specifically taking a break from studying wisdom, what we're going to do instead is try to take a look at a man's life. One of the questions I asked myself this week was, well, what is this going to look like? What would it look like in the Scriptures, anyone who has journeyed this path and gradually discovered how to live more wisely? Now, that doesn't mean more cautiously. It simply means more wisely. Do we have any examples? And not only do we have any examples, but what do the stories of those people look like? So today we're going to look at the life of Abram. And we're going to call it a one-man study in wisdom. I have no idea how far we're going to get. We're just going to move through the story of the man's life. We'll stop at points. We'll look at decisions that he makes. We'll consider the circumstances in which he's making those decisions. And hopefully we'll be able to draw some meaningful help for our own lives and how we make decisions and how God relates to us in the midst of those decisions. All right, so one final favor I'd like to ask of you. For the time being, please suspend all of your former assumptions, teachings, whatever. Well, I know this about Abram, I know that. And I was told that this passage means this, and this over here means that, and these are the conclusions that other people have drawn. Just let the story speak for itself. Just let the life of the man, as it's told to us, speak for itself. So I've asked you to turn over to the 12th chapter, and now we're going to back up from there, and we're going to go to the 27th verse of the 11th chapter. Now these are the generations of Terah. Terah fathered Abram, Nahor, and Haran. And Haran fathered Lot. Okay, so three sons at least recorded, and we should never assume when we read texts like this that these are the only family members. These are just important ones that figure prominently into the story. First off, it's rare that a woman is mentioned. In most genealogies, it's extremely rare that a woman is mentioned, so we have no idea how many daughters he had. Haran died in the presence of his father Terah in the land of his kindred in Ur of the Chaldeans. And Abram and Nahor took wives. The name of Abram's wife was Sarai, and the name of Nahor's wife Milcah, the daughter of Haran, the father of Milcah and Izhar. Now Sarai was barren and had no children. And then verse 31. Terah took Abram his son, and Lot, the son of Haran, his grandson, and Sarai, his daughter-in-law, his son Abram's wife, and they went forth together from Ur of the Chaldeans to go into the land of Canaan. But when they came to Haran, they settled there. The days of Terah were 205 years, and Terah died in Haran. Talk about compressing a lot of information into a couple of words. Now, when you look at that, most of us would just breeze right by that and say, oh, well, there's a couple of interesting facts. But how much life was lived in those three or four sentences? An incredible amount. Well, let's back up then and ask a couple of questions. Why does somebody leave a good thing? So there they are in Ur, and if you know anything about Ur, and I kind of asked you to suspend all of your former knowledge, but Ur would have been civilization at the time. It would have been at the southern eastern tip of what we refer to as the Fertile Crescent. In other words, it was the start of the good area in which humankind and civilization developed. And so, Terah and his kin are there in that city. I'll get that wrong. What makes them leave? They just up and on a whim one day leave? Well, probably not. Here is what I think we might be able to conclude. In any city, and especially a city of that time, the well-being of the population is dependent on the surrounding area's ability to support the population. So let's take New York City today. What makes city living possible in New York City?
At the base level. Meaning food, ship, water, food, necessities of life.
Everything for the sustenance of the people comes from outside the city, apart from maybe somebody who has a rooftop garden and grows a few tomatoes. But the day-to-day sustenance of all of the human beings that live on that island depends on things being transported into that situation every day and things being taken out of that situation every day. In other words, all the things that it makes it possible for civilized society to exist in a dense population is made possible by the surrounding area. New York City is able to be populated to the degree that it is because of the transportation system that it has. How did things get into Ur at that time, do you suppose? I mean, was there an extensive warehousing system outside the city and trucks moved in and out of the city every day bringing foodstuffs and barges hauled the waste out of the city every day? Is that the way it worked? Of course not. So everything had to be born on the backs of people. Everything that the people ate had to be grown in the area around it. So if you were one of the higher ups in the city and you had plenty of affluence and plenty of affluence and influence, you had command of your situation. But what if you were one of the commoners? What if you were one of the ordinary people and things got tough? What do you suppose your lot was like? It wasn't as good. And so we can imagine that over a period of time, this discussion continued. I wonder what it would be like if we went. I wonder what it would be like if we journeyed. And it says that they considered going to Canaan. And so it says here, Terah took Abram, his son, and Lot, the son of Haran, his grandson, and Sarah, his daughter-in-law, his son Abram's wife, and they went forth together. Right there in those few words is a lot of significance. In other words, they were united. Now, you notice what's not there? Kids. It's a few adults who are united in purpose. Why are they leaving? They're leaving because they sense that there is probably a better opportunity somewhere else. They're leaving because they want to leave together. As a matter of fact, if you look up above here, it says, Haran, in other words, one of Terah's sons, Haran died in the presence of his father Terah in the land. So not only are they going to, but it's very likely that they're leaving some of the baggage, some of the unpleasant memories, some of what is there that they don't want to think about anymore, and they're moving on to this new situation. But when they came to Haran, they settled there. Now, they intended to go to Canaan. So the distance, by the way that they were going, to get to Canaan was roughly speaking 1,100 miles, all done on foot. Okay, that would be, if we say that, let's say, Dayton, Ohio is maybe 600 miles from here. That would have been the trip from Ur to Haran. So if you were to start today and walk to Dayton, Ohio, and you didn't take the interstate, you took the back roads, and you had to kind of forage along the way, stop at a river to get a drink, maybe stop at a farmer's place and steal a couple of eggs out from under the chicken, how long do you suppose it's going to take you to walk to Dayton? Couple of years? No, it shouldn't take that long. It could take a few months. Do we agree with that? And what would you feel like at the end of, if you were a city dweller, and city dwelling wasn't equated to what we'd equate it with today, but it was a little bit more comfortable than living out in the wilds. So what do you think your mindset would be at the end of having walked, let's say, 3 months to get to this destination, this interim destination? Anyone? Plug yourself into the story.
That was more desert wilderness. Yeah.
And they saw there a good opportunity. So Ur is way down here. Essentially, they follow the Euphrates River. If you have a map, your map doesn't look like that. I've just invented a new line for the Euphrates River. And they end up here. In Haran. Now, Canaan is down over here. Another 500 miles to walk. Okay, so if you've already walked 600 miles and you find a good opportunity here and you left Ur because you were in search of a better opportunity and the better opportunity presents itself there, what do?
You just stay there.
And that's what they did. And so they stayed there. And Terah died in Haran. No, your map does not look like that. So don't be looking at the map in the back and expect it to look like. I'm just telling you. It sort of looks like that. But and now the Lord said to Abram. Now remember, there's how many of them? Plug yourself into the story. Start to remember the facts. How many of them are there? There's Terah. There's Abram. There's Abram's wife. And there's, who's missing? Anybody? Lot. There's four of them. There's four of them, four adults that leave to go on a journey. Now how many of them are there?
Three.
Terah dies.
Right.
But interestingly enough, things were really good in Haran. We're going to find out how good things were. Now the Lord said to Abram, go from your country and your kindred and your father's house to the land that I will show to you. We're going to come back to that phrase. And I will make of you a great nation, and I will bless you and make your name great so that you will be a blessing. I will bless those who bless you, and him who dishonors you I will curse. And in you all the families of the earth will be blessed. So if you have a Bible that you can underline, that is a really important phrase. That whole concept of blessing is very important. You might want to remember it. So Abram went as the Lord had told him, and Lot with him. Abram was 75 years old when he departed Haran. Okay, now, even if perhaps they didn't reckon age in quite the same way that we do today, even if they didn't, we can say that he was starting to be an advanced in age person. So what are you thinking about when you're 75 years old?
He wasn't retiring.
So let's look at how well they were doing. And so they gathered all their possessions, and they gathered and the people that they had acquired in Haran, and they set out to go to the land of Canaan. Since I butchered that so badly, let's come back and read that again. And Abram took Sarah's wife, and Lot his brother's son, and all of their possessions that they had gathered, and the people that they had acquired in Haran, and they set out to go to the land of Canaan. Do you remember the description about what it was like when they left Ur? Let's turn back and look at that. Terah took Abram his son, and Lot the son of Haran, his grandson, and Sarah his daughter-in-law, and his son Abram's wife, and they went forth together. What's missing? Or more to the point, what's present when they leave Haran that isn't present when they leave Ur? A lot of them too. The people that they had acquired. Interpret that for me, please. Kids, perhaps. Family members that they acquired. Maybe marriages that had taken place along the way. Probably male and female servants that they had acquired or that had voluntarily become part of this mini enterprise. So when they leave Haran, they are not leaving there a poor people. It's been good for them. So at 75 years of age, when Haran has been a good place for you to live, why do you leave? Do you leave? And as a matter of fact, if God, and keep in mind, you and I know this story because it's part of the Bible. And the Bible is a book about God and God's... But suppose you didn't have the Bible to read to tell you about how God interacted with Abram. In other words, suppose you were Abram.
Well, we started getting the picture already while we call him the father of faith. Already, right here.
I want you to look now at what I said we would come back to. Chapter 12. We're going to look at the first verse. Go from your country and your kindred and your father's house. So here's what I want you to leave behind, Abram. I want you to leave behind a secure land. I want you to leave behind family. And I want you finally to leave behind your identity.
Now, he wasn't leaving his wife. His niece. Just take a
look. Okay. I want you to leave your land. I want you to leave your people. I want you to leave your identity. What's left? That's a lot, isn't it?
Yeah.
See, when we read the story today, we think, oh, he's just wandering out into the wilderness. He's leaving behind everything. Well, if you strip this from a man, okay, let's remove all this from you right now. You walk out the door today, right now, and you're not going to have a home anymore. You have no one but your wife and Lot and a couple of servants, and you are going to a place where your name and your identity is meaningless. Are you a little nervous now? And what's the hope of all this? The hope of all this is that he is going to be a blessing, but he doesn't even understand how. And he is going to be the kind of a person who is going to make things better wherever he goes, but he doesn't understand any of that yet. Why pick this guy? Well, I believe we pick this guy because he's adventurous, first off. Let's not minimize the human quality that Abraham has of being adventurous. What makes four people decide that they're going to go on a 600-mile journey to seek better opportunity or to seek a different opportunity? It's the same thing that might make a person who was called by God go and say, you know, I think I will do that. I think we can do that. And here's the more interesting thing. The call comes to Abram. Somehow Abram is able to convince his wife and Lot, who seems to want to go along, and all the members of this entourage, that they're all going to go.
I'm kind of holding back. You say a couple of things. I think you're going to say that. But he also left his gods behind. All this God he was hearing from was new. He was God, but he left his gods, his family's gods behind. And God saw something in his heart. That this man will respond to me. This man will. And then the other thing, dead Aaron.
So as we think about this, is this a wise decision? Here's a principle that we can take from this so far. We've said already that the fear of the Lord is the beginning of wisdom. I just have to erase the Euphrates River here a minute. There we go. So we've said that the fear of the Lord is the beginning of wisdom, and so when I build my life on the foundation of a confidence in God, then I've built my life on something solid. But how many of us start out life building on the sand over here? Remember what Jesus said? If you take the time to build a solid foundation on my principles and my teachings, you'll have something that can weather the storms of life. But if you build over here, off this foundation, you might build a grand structure. But there's no guarantee that it's going to endure long term. And so Abram, right at this point, is a man like most of us. So let's not canonize him for sainthood yet. Abram is a man who has a very small percentage of his life built on the foundation of God, and a very large percentage of his life built on his own understandings. He's got just a tip of his life built right there, just enough that God can work with. Here's a question. How many of you have ever been frustrated with your spiritual progress? How many of you have ever thought, I should be further along. I shouldn't think this way anymore. I shouldn't behave this way anymore. I should be much more mature. And yet the evidence of this man is probably no, you're probably in very good company if it's taking you a lot longer to apparently it's not built on a solid foundation. All right. Let's move along. So Abram went, as the Lord had told him, and Lot went with him, and Abram was 75 years old, remember that number again, when he departed from Haran. And Abram took Sarah his wife, and Lot his brother's son, and all of his possessions that they had gathered, and the people that they had acquired in Haran, and they set out to go to the land of Canaan. And remember what I said, it's another 500 miles. Only this 500 miles actually is more difficult than the first 500 miles, because at least they could follow the general course of the Euphrates River up which I erased so you can't see it anymore. In other words, they had fresh water. What's that?
Now the geography is going to be mountainous.
Yeah. The terrain is difficult. The journey is more difficult. The food and water supplies are more difficult. And they're older. So just place yourself in that situation. Place yourself in that situation with your wife. Place yourself in that situation with the entourage of people. And they set out to go to the land of Canaan. And when they came to the land of Canaan, Abram passed through the land to the place of Shechem, to the oak of Moreh. All right, so they arrive there, and it's not like, remember I said if you were going to Dayton, Ohio, that was about that. It's not like there was a sign a little bit further down that said, we'll say, welcome to Indiana. There was no sign. It was just kind of like, oh, I guess we're in this general region. We're in this general territory. And so they walk for a while until they find what looks like a favorable spot. Abram passed through the land to the place of Shechem, to the oak of Moreh. At that time, the Canaanites were in the land. And so right there is another textual clue that this is written years later. Okay, this tradition is passed down orally for quite some time before it is finally put to writing. Then the Lord appeared to Abram and said, to your offspring I will give this land. So he built there an altar to the Lord who had appeared to him. From there he moved on to the hill country on the east. Okay. What comes to mind when you hear from God again? What's the promise? What's the promise? Don't look at me. What's the promise that God gives him? It's in the text. Huh? And? Somebody to occupy the land. What good is land if you don't have people to stay in it, right? It wouldn't be much of a gift. Now, what comes to mind when you're Abram? And you're 75. And God promises you land that he's going to give to your offspring. I'm too old to have offspring. What's up with this? Okay, something needs to happen soon. There's not much question about this, though. So, and keep in mind, we don't know what Abram's frame of mind is yet. We don't know if he's just confused, if he doesn't understand. He just remembers this simple phrase. And we have to assume that he is the person who tells this story to others, who in turn tell it to others. In other words, he is the person who ultimately tells his sons, or his son, who tells his son this story. And that's how it gets passed on. To your offspring I will give this land. So there he built an altar to the Lord who had appeared to him. From there he moved to the hill country on the east of Bethel and pitched his tent with Bethel on the west and Ai on the east. And there he built an altar to the Lord and called upon the name of the Lord. And Abram journeyed on, still going toward the Negev. And we'll come back to that. Ron, your mission for the rest of the morning is to keep track of the board. What's that? There we go. All right. So they come from Haran. They make stop number one at Shechem. They make stop number two near Bethel. At the first place, it says that Abram builds an altar because God has spoken to him. But something interesting happens. By the time they get to the next place, Abram builds an altar because Abram wants to talk to God. Two encounters, but by now something has shifted in his mentality already. That's a real cup, John.
Yes.
And Abram journeyed on, still going toward the Negev. All right. Fancy name for the south. So he's going through the land. He's going from through the land from north to south. If this is in fact the land that God is giving me, I guess I'm going to continue on. Now, by this time, he's started sort of what we'd call a migratory route that a shepherd would have. He started this go from place to place to place. And why does a shepherd have to move? Anybody?
Or grazing.
Grass, right, grass. so you can't overgraze. But also keep in mind something else. Whose land is this? Is it his? No, it's not his. And so we might even conclude that while the story says that he was making his way there, we might even conclude that the people were helping him to make his way there because he didn't for any length of time receive a friendly reception where he went. And so he ends up down here. It's the driest, hottest part of all of the land, and that's where he finds himself.
Yeah, the north is green and grassy and mountainous, but it's very green and lakes up there.
This, incidentally, later on, if you know anything about the history of modern Israel, this is the area where they first begin these communal farms in Israel that becomes the nation of Israel later, and they start to establish something. They get the worst of the worst, and from the worst of the worst land in Palestine is where Israel starts to build a nation. All right, that was modern day, which you probably didn't care about. Anyway, now there was a famine in the land, so Abram went down to Egypt to sojourn there.
Can you back up a second?
Yeah.
It was interesting. They were at Moran those years. The thing was, God said, I didn't tell you this. This is not the land I'm giving you. And he had to obey once again and listen to the Lord. And it was good there, prosperous there, like you said. But we have to leave again, or I'm going to obey and leave again. It's all good here.
Now, there's an interesting turn here. Now, there was a famine in the land. And so what does Abram do? Yes, he does. Now, think for yourself. Have you ever made a major life decision and started to second guess it? I mean, let's say you're 2 or 3 years into the life decision and it's really going badly for you. Now, Abram had only two options at this point. Okay, he's in the middle of dry heat. It says the entire land is suffering from a famine, so we assume that maybe it's a little difficult there. What are his two options? His two options are either press ahead, go in that direction toward better, or turn around and go back up that way and go toward better. To his credit, Abram chooses to continue, not necessarily in occupying the land, but he doesn't. He resists the temptation simply to turn around and go back to where he knew it was good and where he knew he could survive. And I think a lot of us get stuck there. See, we think that if we make the decisions that God calls us to make, that at very least it's not going to get worse. We understand it might not always get better, or it certainly might not get better right away, but we don't think it's going to turn from okay to worse. But that's not the story of Abram's life. The story is of getting worse. All right. And so here's the deal that they make. They're ready to cross over into the land of Egypt. It says, so Abram says to his wife, I know that you are a woman beautiful in appearance. And when the Egyptians see you, they will say, this is his wife. And then they will kill me, but they will let you live. So you are... So say that you are my sister, that it may go well with me because of you, that my life may be spared for your sake. So what's he doing? Man that he is.
He's hiding behind his wife.
He said, you know what? In the place where we're going, they may see you, they may like you, they may want you, and if I say that we're married, they may just off me so that they can have you. And so what I'd like you to do is just play this little charade where you're just going to pretend to be my sister, and then it'll be okay for me. Now we read this story, and we don't notice one thing. And I'm convinced that most people don't notice this one thing. So it says, and when the princes of Pharaoh saw that, her, they praised her to Pharaoh, and the woman was taken into Pharaoh's house. And for her sake, he dealt well with Abram. And he had sheep and oxen and male donkeys and male servants and female donkeys and camels. So it seems that his lot in life was already good, and it gets better when he goes there. Where is he to live? What's his call from God? His call from God. is up here. He is down here. Now, think about this. When he devises this ruse wherein his wife is going to be his sister, what is his exit strategy from Egypt? Does he suppose that one day Pharaoh is just going to give him back his wife so that he can leave home? How's he ever going to get out of Egypt? He's only got two choices. He either sticks around in Egypt until she dies, and then he's free to leave, or he abandons her and goes back. How can he ever get back to this land as long as she is married to Pharaoh? So he's worked himself into a bad deal. Remember the foundation that we built? A little on God, a lot over here, and we said that Abram was right there. This is the first lesson in when I don't trust God, the foundation that I have for myself built on my own understanding starts to crumble. See, he doesn't even understand when he makes this deal with his wife that he's stuck in Egypt for the rest of his life if he follows through on that. There's no way for him to leave until she dies or unless he abandons her.
The fear clouds our clarity and able to reason and work that out. She was his half-sister. It was part of the truth.
We don't see that yet. You'll learn that later.
Okay, so, and he didn't have the Ten Commandments yet. That was Moses, so it's not be too hard.
Oh, I'm not being hard on him. All I'm saying is...
But we are. We get that.
Oh, no. This is very normal for all of us, I think. But the Lord afflicted Pharaoh and his house with great plagues because of Sarah, Abram's wife. So Pharaoh called Abram and said, "What is this that you have done to me? Why did you not tell me that she is your wife? Why did you say, 'She is my sister,' so that I took her for my wife? Now then, here is your wife. Take her and go." And Pharaoh gave men orders concerning him, and they sent him away with his wife and all that he had. Now when you read that last sentence, what's really being said there? Anybody? Pharaoh wants to make sure that this lying man who has misrepresented things is escorted across the border and out of the land. I want you guys to follow this man and his entourage back across the border and make sure he stays across the border and goes back up that way, because things have gone very bad for me with him in the land and his lying like that. Have we ever gotten ourselves into messes, and in the process of getting ourselves into messes, it misrepresents God as well as us?
Yep.
And that's part of what happens here. And interestingly, what we see is the curse. Remember the mission statement that God has for Abram? But I said underline that and we'd come back to it. "I will bless you and make your name great so that you will be a blessing." Let me read that again. "I will bless you and make your name great so that you will be a blessing." How did that work out for Pharaoh? So in the process, and that was part of God's mission, wherever you go, you are going to be a blessing to the people that you are with. But when we build our house on our own foundation, in the end, we can't even fulfill the purpose that God has for us. So Abram went up from Egypt, he and his wife, and all that he had, and Lot with him, into the Negev. Now, we're not clear if the famine is over. The famine may not be over, but they're out. Now Abram was... Right, which is pretty amazing. So we might actually want to say that the fear of God was in Pharaoh. At that moment, as a matter of fact, Pharaoh was probably a more honorable man than Abram. So for all those times in life when you say, "Well, the people who aren't Christians seem to be nicer and more honorable than the Christians," yeah, there's some truth to that. Okay, so now Abram was very rich in livestock and silver and gold, and he journeyed on from the Negev as far as Bethel to the place where his tent had been at the beginning. Actually, it was the second place that he stopped. And to the place where he had made an altar at the first. And there Abram called upon the name of the Lord, and Lot, who went with Abram also had flocks and herds and tents, so that the land could not support both of them dwelling together, for their possessions were so great that they could not dwell together. And so there was strife between the herdsmen. Okay, so the next dilemma. What's happened? They've been blessed so much. They've both been, and this is important, they are both prudent business people. They're both not only knowledgeable shepherds, but they're also knowledgeable business people. They know how to manage the wealth that they have and allow it to produce more. They are both what we'd call good stewards of what they have. But a conflict arises. All right. And Abram said to Lot, "Let there be no strife between you and me, between your herdsmen and my herdsmen, for we are kinsmen. Is not the whole of the land before you? Separate yourself from me, and if you take the left hand, then I will go to the right, or if you take the right hand, then I will go to the left." So he gives Lot the choice. There's a difference that takes place, though, here. It says that when Abram comes out of Egypt, and he finally finds a place to land again, what's the first thing that he does there? Anybody? Yeah. Or he goes to the altar that was there. In other words, now, his first action when he gets into an area is he goes to commune with God. And this is the first time where the decision that he is going to make that is going to impact somebody else occurs immediately after he's had communion with God and established a place where he can meet with God. This is a very important principle. Again, another learning point. First, I make a place where God and I can communicate and I can seek God's wisdom and counsel, and then I make the decisions that I will make about the people that I'm with and the finances that I have to manage. And so what does he do? He offers Lot the choice instead of himself. Now, what would our choice have been? After all, who's in charge of this dog and pony show, this traveling circus?
Yeah.
It's Abram. So who should make? Who should logically make the decision?
Abram.
Having met with God, having fellowship with God, Abram offers the choice to Lot. It might be the first time now that he's really demonstrating a day-to-day trust in God. And so we see Lot picks the best of the best. All right, so I'm going to draw again. We know how well that goes. So Abram is up here, and we're going to say, call that the hill country. And remember, they're trying to graze all their sheep up here in the hill country. And Lot looks over this way, and the Jordan's flowing there. So we can assume river, good grass here. This is the best place to take my sheep. And Lot is brazen enough to say, well, I think I'm going to go this way where all the green stuff is and leave you up here in the hills. Why does Abram tolerate that? It's an amazing acquiescence to say, okay, I've made this pledge to you. If you want all the green and all the good, you go there. And he does. Listen to what God says immediately after that. And the Lord said to Abram, after Lot had left him, "Lift up your eyes and look from the place where you are, northward and southward, eastward and westward. For all the land that you will see, I will give to you and to your offspring forever. I will make your offspring as..." Is anybody following along with me? "As the dust of the earth." Now, isn't that an interesting phrase? If you had just spent 2 or 3 years in dryness and in the desert area of the land, would dust have a significance to you? If every day you woke up and there was dust and dirt and sand in everything you owned, and it was in your toes and it was in your eyes and it was everywhere, and you were a man with exactly no children, none, and God makes this promise, "I will make your offspring as the dust of the earth, so that if one could count the dust of the earth, your offspring could also be counted. And so arise and walk through the length and the breadth of the land, for I will give it to you." So Abram moved his tent and came and settled by the oaks of Mamre, which are at Hebron. And there he built an altar to the Lord. I think there's an interesting circumstance that takes place there. Have you ever been to the edge of your ability to trust God? I did the right thing and this is not going well, and I tried the right thing over here and it's not going well. And it seems right here as if this is the first time where Abram does something good for someone else. And in return, God notices and makes a promise to him almost immediately and says, I've seen what you're doing, and I want to assure you that don't worry about how your nephew got what you think is the best stuff. You don't worry about that. You keep your eye focused on the promise that I have made to you. You keep your eye focused on the mission that I have given you to be a blessing to other people. And don't worry about the good stuff that's happening to other people. I'm going to take care of you. And so Abram moved his tent and came and settled by the oaks of Mamre, which are at Hebron. And there he built an altar to the Lord. That seems to be part of his practice now. Wherever I go, I'm going to set up a place where I can commune with God. Because it seems that if I'm going to live this life that God's asked me to live, it goes better when I do this. How long does it take you to learn lessons? Just think about that. Remember this, he doesn't have this book. He doesn't know what God is supposed to behave like. He doesn't have pages and pages of past history that he can read to understand how to relate to God. All he's got is what he's going by a day at a time, a month at a time, a year at a time. It seems to work when I do this. It seems to go bad when I do that. Do you have your own history with God? I mean, your own real personal relationship with God, because we say personal relationship with God, but usually we just follow the herd and do what everybody else does. Do you have your own routines and rhythms and practices that you and God have fellowship together? Or do you need to build some of them? Have you ever stopped and paused and asked the question, when does God seem to show up the most in my life? When does He show up the least? What decisions do I make that seem to go the worst for me, and what decisions do I make that seem to go the best for me, and what has happened in advance of those decisions? Those are important questions. And I think we get a little lax and a little lazy. But suppose you were in a land with no family, and it wasn't your land, and you weren't going back, and you had no one to depend on but God. Would you take the relationship a little bit more seriously? So most of us have what we need. We don't really, truly, as much as we say, well, I need God. The truth is, how many of you have food at home in your refrigerator? A little bit on the shelves in the pantry? A little gas in the car? Insurance paid? Rent, mortgage, all taken care of? See, most of us say we need God, but we don't really need God in the way that this man needed God. And then here comes another storm. Chapter 14. I'm going to tell the story rather than read the story because it's long and it's confusing. So unbeknownst to Abram, or at least it's not told thus far, the land to which Lot moved was sort of like a vassal nation. Or collection of nations, a collection of city-states. In other words, they regularly paid tribute, exorbitant taxes, to a king of Syria. And then one day they decide, that's it, we're not going to pay these taxes, we're not going to live under this threat anymore, and so they rebel. And as you might expect, the king who was getting the taxes came to town. Because he wanted his money back. It was a good thing. It says for 12 years, he had been getting this tribute paid to him. Year after year after year. And in the 13th year, the people said, that's it, we're not doing this anymore. And the king had to come down. So unbeknownst to Abram, we could say that Abram walks into a country that's now a war zone. And what would that feel like? And isn't it interesting? This region is still at war. People in this area can't get along no matter what. And it says that the people come down there, and he doesn't have a personal interest in the people so much as he seems to have a concern for one person, Lot. He says, Lot, the guy who had chosen the green stuff, the best of the land, the best opportunity, Lot is taken. And so Abram has to go after Lot. Do you remember Abram in Egypt? Abram who had to hide behind his wife. This is an amazing contradiction. So here is Abram. Abram was afraid for his own life and put his wife out in front of him as a shield when he goes to meet Pharaoh. And here all of a sudden, it says, and I want to get this right, I want to read this. When Abram heard that his kinsman, who is Lot, had been taken captive, he led forth his trained men, born in his house, 318 of them, and they went in pursuit as far as Dan. Okay, so Jordan, Dead Sea, what we call Galilee, Sea of Galilee. Abram is here. Dan is way up here. The kings come down this way. They take the stuff. They go back that way. Abram goes all the way up there to chase them with 300 people. 300 plus soldiers again. And remember, it says trained men. But these are trained men that are trained shepherds. Okay, so in between tending the sheep, they might have to use their swords to kill a lion or a whatever, a predator. I don't picture them out there doing drills every day. So 300 people go up against the armies of four kings who are united. Now, do you remember Abram? Has to hide behind his wife. Where does this level of bravery come? I think I'm going to go get Lot back and I'm going to take on these four armies. This is an amazing reversal. What's different? A growing confidence in God and a willingness to step out and something important to him on the line. I hope that in the process of this, you're starting to get a different picture of this man because, we set a guy like this up as this paragon of everything that we should be. This man is the most mixed bag of for God one day and not sure the next and off on the fringes the following. All right. So we're going to bypass the part about Abram meeting Melchizedek because we've covered that so often. We just did that a number of months ago when we did the Blessed Life series. So we're going to move over to chapter 15. And it says, after these things, the word of the Lord came to Abram in a vision. Fear not, Abram. I am your shield. Your reward shall be very great. Again, an interesting word. I am your shield. Remember the word God uses when he says about his offspring? It's dust. It's related to where Abram was at the time. What's the word God uses now? I am your shield. Immediately after battle, Abram senses the need for protection. What would you be worried about if you'd just taken on four kings and come back? Now let's just think about this. What would you do if you just took on the mob, got your family back, and came back home? Yeah, retaliation. I wonder who's coming for me now. After these things, the word of the Lord came to Abram in a vision. Fear not, Abram. I am your shield, and your reward shall be very great. But Abraham said, O Lord God, what will you give me? For I continue childless. In other words, you know that promise you made about the dust and the kids being like the dust and all that? It would be good if we started somewhere. How about one? What do you say we just start with one kid? And the heir of my house is Eleazar of Damascus. And Abram said, Behold, you have given me no offspring, and a member of my household will be my heir. And behold, the word of the Lord came to him. This man shall not be your heir. Your very own son shall be your heir. And he brought him outside and said, Look toward the heaven and number the stars if you were able to number them. And then he said to him, So shall your offspring be. And he believed the Lord, and he counted it to him as righteousness. Verse number 7. And he said to him, I am the Lord who brought you out of Ur of the Chaldeans. Now that's where we see this interesting statement. It seems to us as if Abram leaves Haran. That Abram's call begins in Haran. But in God's mind, where does Abram's call begin? All the way back in Ur. All the way back down here. So God had a plan for Abram long, long, long before Abram was aware of the fact that God had a plan for him. Have you ever been suspicious of the fact that your life is predominantly a collection of random events that just have somehow conspired to make you who you are and what you are? Because this would suggest that maybe not. That maybe even all the junk that you were going through before you were ever aware of God, that God was somehow in the middle of that, moving things around and making things happen to set you up for the purpose that He has for you. I am the Lord who brought you out of Ur of the Chaldeans to give you the land to possess. But he said, O Lord, how am I to know that I shall possess it? This is really interesting. So at this moment, look right above here. So shall your offspring be. And he believed the Lord, and the Lord counted to him as righteousness. So he has no kids. None. God says, don't worry, I'm going to give you kids. And it's Abram says, okay, I believe you. I still believe you. We jump down just a little bit here, and it says, how will I know that you're going to give me the land? Have you ever been settled in your confidence with God about one thing and completely in doubt about something other? Have you lived with this duality of I believe God for this, but I'm not sure if I can trust God about that? Again, have you felt disappointed with yourself thinking I should be beyond this? Well, maybe not. But he said, O Lord, how am I to know that I shall possess it? And he said to him, bring me a heifer 3 years old, a female goat 3 years old, and a ram 3 years old, and a turtle dove, and a young pigeon. And he brought them all, and cut them in half, and laid each half over against itself. But he did not cut the birds in half. Okay, so this seems really weird. So what's all this about? God is a promise keeper, but He's not just a promise keeper. God is a covenant maker. In other words, we could say that God enters into arrangements with people and gives them His word. So we have half an animal, 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 half an animal. Look at the text, read the text. It says, cut them in half and lay them. Kind of like you slice the cow in half, you flip the cow over, and there's a little bit of space here between the left half of the cow and the right half of the cow. And you go on and we do the whatever the next animal is and so on and so on. It was an ancient custom for a person to walk right through the middle of that. And here's what happened. Here's what was said. Both parties would actually, in this case, in this covenant relationship, both parties were supposed to walk through the middle of this. And the understanding was, if I do not live up to this end of my end of things, or if you do not live up to it, you will be like this. So will you be. The understanding is, I have sworn on my life that I will do this, and if I do not do it, may I look like this. May what happened to this animal happen to me. Does everybody understand that? In the end, if you read the story, there's only one party that walks through this gauntlet, if you will. It says that after dark, behold, a smoking firepot and a flaming torch passed between these pieces. On that day, the Lord made a covenant with Abram, saying, to your offspring, I give this land from the river of Egypt to the great river, the river of the Euphrates, the land of the Kenites, and the Kenites, all those people that live in the land right now. And God says, there's only one person needs to walk through this. I'm responsible. You are not. This is all on me. I will make this happen. You have my word on it. Let this happen to me if I do not make this happen.
Are you going to say this next part or not?
Go ahead.
And God who makes a covenant does not renege on his covenant. And that is still for the Jewish people today. Abraham is the first Jewish man. All of them descendants are his. He has not reneged on that covenant with Israel yet. I could go on and on. But that is why we are called to pray for them and bless them. And if we do, we'll be blessed. If not, we'll be cursed. That's the first one of the first reasons. Out of him came Jesus Christ, who has blessed the whole nation, the world. But God has not gone back to that yet. God upholds his word. Centuries later, he's faithful.
Well, it's symbolism for God. Can I explain it specifically? No. Well, something has to be a visible representation of it, and so that becomes the visible representation. Okay, so understanding this and having experienced this, and once in a world event, okay? Not just once in a lifetime. Once in a world event kind of thing happens here. And so don't expect that this is going to happen in your backyard anytime soon. It probably won't. Now, immediately after that, what would you feel like? What would your confidence level be like? It would be good, right? Remember the foundation? Now, what should be happening here? Okay, so all this is happening, and remember the simple illustration. This is God. This is my plan. This is the life that I'm going to build. The more that my life is on the foundation of God, the stronger it is, the more it's on myself, on my plan, the less likely it is that over the course of time that this life that I've built is going to remain intact. So if that's true, and you have just experienced that event, then you would think that the course of Abram's life would be shifting more to a foundation on God and less to a foundation of my plan, would you not? Doesn't that seem reasonable? And we would all think that, wouldn't we? Well, are you logical? I mean, despite the fact that you think you are you really logical about everything that you do? So here we are. Let's look at Abram's life again. Chapter 16. Now Sarah, Abram's wife, had borne him no children. She had a female Egyptian servant whose name was Hagar. And Sarah said to Abram, "Behold now, the Lord has prevented me from bearing children. Go into my servant. It may be that I shall obtain children by her." And Abram listened to the voice of Sarai. And so after Abram had lived 10 years in the land of Canaan, Sarai, Abram's wife, took Hagar, the Egyptian, her servant, and gave her to Abram, her husband, as a wife. And he went to Hagar, and she conceived. And when she saw that she had conceived, she looked with contempt on her mistress. Okay, another one of these weird stories. Do you understand what's going on? Okay, so Sarah says, "Well, it doesn't look like I'm going to be able to have kids. Here's my plan. How about you take this woman who works for me and we'll make her sort of like a second wife to you, and maybe she can bear some kids for you." And sure enough, the plan works. It's foolproof. There it is. And there's a kid on the way. And the second that there's a kid on the way, what happens? There's immediately bad blood. The second wife now feels a little superior to the first wife because she's able to have kids and the first wife isn't. Meanwhile, the first wife is jealous and resents the second wife because the very thing that she wanted to happen has happened. And there's Abram off to the side.
You stuck in the middle.
And Sarah said to Abram, "May the wrong done to me be on you. I gave my servant to your embrace, and when she saw that she had conceived, she looked on me with contempt. May the Lord judge between you and me." But Abram said to Sarai, "Behold, your servant is in your power. Do to her as you please." Then Sarai dealt harshly with her, and she fled from her. Remember the blessing part? I'm going to bless you so that you will be a blessing to others. Is it at times true that we are a blessing to others outside our home, and yet within our home, we're less of a blessing? Because that would seem to be the story that's taking place and unfolding here. That I can help other people. I can take 300 men and go to war in a foreign country to save a kinsman of mine, but I'm not sure if I can make things work in my own house so that there's harmony in my own house. Does your life ever feel like that? Does your life ever feel like it's one step forward and one step back and one step sideways and boy, I don't know what God's going to do next? And you're in good company. And so Hagar leaves and it takes, and we're not going to spend much time here because this is a little bit off story. So we'll go down to verse 15 of chapter 16. "And Hagar bore Abram a son." So this is the outcome of this. "And Abram called the name of the son whom Hagar bore Ishmael. And Abram was 86 years old when Hagar bore Ishmael for Abraham." So that's 11 years after he left Haran. There's a lot has happened in this man's life in 11 years. Where were you in 2004? Probably can't remember, can you? What was going on in your life in 2004? What's happened in the last 11 years? Well, at very least, we can probably say that you haven't uprooted, moved into a new territory that really wasn't your home, lived in a tent, went to Egypt, came back from Egypt, started a small army, and went and took your friend back and came back with him. You probably, and got a second wife, right? That probably hasn't all happened to you in 11 years. He's lived in an interesting 11 years. Abram was 86 years old when Hagar bore Ishmael to Abram. When Abram was 99 years old, okay, you got the picture there? There's nothing said about this man's life. Here it is. When Abram was 86, we pick up at the next chapter. When Abram was 99, wouldn't you like to know what happened in those years? That's a pretty long stretch. "The Lord appeared to Abram and said to him, 'I am God Almighty, walk before me, be blameless, that I may make my covenant between me and you and may multiply you greatly.'" So let's just stop there. Are there seasons in your life when you think you're hearing from God and things are fresh and there's interesting stuff happening all the time? And then is it possible that there are other dry seasons where it seems dry and it seems ordinary and it seems like there's no contact from God, and you start to wonder if all this stuff that happened in a former season in your life you just made up and it really wasn't real? Because look at the time frame here. Between the end of chapter 16 and the beginning of chapter 17, there's 13 years. Remember the 11 interesting years? Armies and Egypt and camping all over in the desert and nighttime skies and then 13 years of absolute nothing. What do you think when you don't hear from God for 13 years? That's a long time. You hang on to that fact. Yeah, that's a very long time. When Abram was 99 years old, the Lord appeared to Abram and said to him, "I am God Almighty. Walk before me and be blameless." At which point you would have to think that Abram was saying, "Listen, I've been trying to do that. It's been a long time. Thanks for showing up."
Saying the same thing.
Yeah. that I may make my covenant between me and you and may multiply you greatly. And Abram fell on his face, and God said, and behold, my covenant is with you, and you shall be the father of a multitude of nations. Now, you just have to think that going on in the back of Abram's mind right now is, oh, here it comes again. It's the old, I'm going to be the father of many nations, and the dust, and the kids, and the stars in the sky, and all that, and here it comes again.
Heard this before,
yes. No longer shall your name be Abram, but your name shall be Abraham, for I have made you the father of a multitude of nations. So now he's not just going to be the father of a nation, he's going to be the father of multiple nations. I'm going to make you exceedingly fruitful, and I will make you into nations, and kings shall come from you, and I will establish my covenant between me and you and your offspring after you throughout their generations for an everlasting covenant. And I will give to you and your offspring after you the land of your sojournings, all the land of Canaan. So again, what's the promise? Lots of people and a place for them to live. And God said to Abram, as for you, you shall keep my covenant, you and your offspring after you throughout your generations. This is my covenant that you shall keep between me and you and your offspring after you. Every male among you shall be circumcised. You shall be circumcised in the flesh of your foreskin, and it shall be a sign of covenant between me and you. Okay, so I'm sure Abram was all about the part about chopping the animals in half, and that was going to be a covenant. But this is a different kind of chopping, and maybe this covenant isn't so cool. And incidentally, and you all know this, right? There's a big difference between sharp surgical stainless steel and flint. There's a really big difference. There's a big difference between being 8 days old and not quite knowing what's happening to you and being 99 years old and fully aware of what's happening to you. This is a really big deal. Now, why do you suppose this is important? And I really camped on this for a while. Because it's really good to read the entire story, to see a person's whole life as it plays out with God, instead of just looking at a little snippet. We're years into this journey. And Abram's got to be wondering, if this is for real, if I have really heard God correctly, if I have understood all this correctly, this is so long in coming, and now God is finally asking for one more thing. It still relates back to the original purpose. I'm going to make you and yours a blessing. And this weird, quirky thing is going to be a constant reminder to each generation that will follow. You're here for a reason. You are here because of a covenant between you and God, and you have a purpose to serve. And God is already looking forward to the fact that you are going to be, this is my mission for you, you are going to be a people set up in a specific place to represent me well so that other people are going to be able to start to understand what it means to relate to me because they're going to watch you relate to me. And so every generation is going to tell this to the next generation. Tell this to the next generation. You see, Abram's worried about, are you ever going to give me a kid? Are you ever going to give me a place that I can settle down and call my own? Now, those are not small goals. Those are nice goals, and those are comfortable goals, and those are goals that any person might want. Are you going to give me a place that I can call my own? Are you finally going to give me a family? But what's God's bigger purpose behind this? There's a whole world full of people out there. There's a whole world full of people out there who have no connection with me, who have no identity, who have no purpose, who are wandering about in confusion, and I care as much about them as I care about you. And as important as land and a kid is to you, all these people are to me. Why has God given you what He's given you? Why has God given me what He's given me? That's a big question. And when we ask, and when we think that God has told us something, or we ask God for something, and we think we've received a promise from Him, yes, I'm going to provide that for you. Why does He give us what He gives us? James says that sometimes we don't get what we ask for because what do we want to do with it? We just want to consume it for our own benefit, for our own immediate personal satisfaction. Why does God give us the stuff that He gives us? And do we at times misappropriate it and merely use it for our own personal satisfaction? And I'm not trying to make any of us feel guilty. We all do this, right? We all do this. But the story of this man's life is that while he's asking the question, when are you going to give me a kid? When are you going to give me some land to settle down? God has got a bigger picture. Abram, you've never even asked me why I called you out of there to begin with. You've never even asked me about this blessing stuff. You're so, all that you hear of the promise that I keep giving you is I'm going to have an heir to take over the family business. I'm going to have an heir to take over the family fortune. Right now, I don't have anybody. And so while Abram is looking for the answer in one way, God is trying to give him the answer in another, and it doesn't seem that Abram is quite there yet. But to his credit, every male throughout your generations, whether born in your house or brought with money, for any foreigner who is not of your offspring, both he who is born in your house and he who is bought with money shall surely be circumcised. So shall my covenant in your flesh be an everlasting covenant. And it says that Abram went right out and did that. And God said to Abram, as for Sarah your wife, you shall not call her Sarai, but Sarah shall be her name. And I will bless her. And moreover, I will give to you a son by her. I will bless her. And she shall become nations, and kings of people shall come from her. And then Abram fell on his face. And this is interesting. Abram fell on his face. And what do you expect is going to be the next word? To worship or to do something, right? It says, Abram fell on his face and he laughed. Right? It's not good to stand up when you're laughing at God. It's best if you kind of like try to hide your face while you laugh. I mean, this is just so honest. Oh, here it comes again. And Abram said to God, oh, that Ishmael might live before you. And God said, no, but Sarah, your wife, shall bear you a son, and you shall call his name Isaac. Now, look, the promise is going on to a new level. You notice before the promise was, I'm going to give you a son. I'm going to give you multiple sons, offspring. I'm going to give you a large family. Now God's taken to naming the kid. Now think about this. I'm not only going to give you a kid, let me tell you what his name is going to be. As for Ishmael, I have heard you. Behold, I have blessed him and will make him fruitful and multiply him greatly. He shall father 12 princes, and I will make him into a great nation. Now, isn't that interesting? So, Abram and Sarah devised this plot by which they're going to help God. And I'm not saying there's anything wrong with that. I mean, we could get into a whole litany of things about what might be wrong with it. But isn't it interesting? God blesses that. God sees what they're trying to do, and God blesses that. Abram says, well, can't you bless him? And God says, yes, I will bless him. What's your assumption about what happens when you do something wrong? Or when you venture out on your own and it's outside God's will? What's your automatic assumption about what God's going to do? Let's just be honest. The word smote somehow comes to mind. Smote is a good word. Smote and God fit together well in a lot of people's mindset. You've been very quiet this morning. Very quiet. When he had finished talking with him, God went up before Abram. Then Abram took Ishmael, his son, and all those born in his house who were bought with money, and every male among the men of Abram's house, and he circumcised the flesh of their foreskins that very day, as God had said to them. End of interaction. 99 years old, still waiting for the first real son. Now you've named the son. And another little bit of time goes by, and the Lord appeared to him by the oaks of Mamre as he sat at the door of his tent in the heat of the day. And he lifted up his eyes and looked, and behold, there were three men there standing in front of him. And when he saw them, he ran from the tent door to meet them and bowed himself to the earth and said, O Lord, if I have found favor in your sight, do not pass your servant. Let a little water be brought. Anyway, three visitors come. So the three visitors come, and Abram, being a man of hospitality, in the middle of nowhere, he invites them in and he says, let me give you a meal. And he realizes that there's somebody special. And so after he's fed them, and after and as they're enjoying the fellowship, he says, and they said to him, where is Sarah, your wife? And he said, she is in the tent. And the Lord said, I will surely return to you about this time next year, and Sarah, your wife, shall have a son. And Sarah was listening at the tent door behind him. Now Abram and Sarah were old, advanced in years. Remember how old Abram was? Anybody? 99 years old. And a few more months may have passed by before this exchange. 99, and it says that Sarah is 90 years old. Okay? This is what we might want to call today a nursing home romance. And the Lord said to Abram, why did Sarah laugh and say, shall I indeed bear a child now that I am old? Is anything too hard for the Lord? At the appointed time, I will return to you about this time next year, and Sarah shall have a son. But Sarah denied it, saying, oh, I did not laugh, for she was afraid. And he said, no, but you did laugh. Well, what do you think?
This is a good point.
And so they have their little exchange. And then the men are going to leave. And as the story goes, the men are going down to the place of Sodom, and they're going to check out what they've heard about in Sodom. And so the men turned from there and went towards Sodom, but Abram still stood before the Lord. And then Abram drew near and said, will you indeed sweep away the righteous with the wicked? And so Abram starts to bargain with God about the fate of the cities. Now, is he concerned about people? Probably. Is he concerned about Lot who lives there? Most definitely. Now, I got to say, this is an amazing story right here, because there must have been, we don't see this revealed, but there must have been some disappointment. Okay, so remember the friction back in the plains when they first come back out of Egypt and there's not enough grazing area and Lot's men are fighting with Abram's men, and Abram says, you take the best of the land. You take whatever you want. How did that go for him? We ended up down in Sodom, and Abram knows it isn't necessarily his fault that the kings come down and invade and he gets taken hostage. But what does Abram do? He goes and rescues him. Now, where does Lot go when he's done being rescued? Right back to Sodom. Now, we don't know this, but how do you suspect this makes Abram feel? Would you be disappointed? Would you be hurt? Would you be a little... But where is Abram? Abram still knows what's going on. And incidentally, if you were to look at a map, you'd see Salt Sea, the Dead Sea, whatever. Abram's over here. Lot is somewhere down in here. One of these coastal towns down here, along the east bank of this river. Or, well, river and lake. There's not day-to-day communication. But it's close enough that messengers could move back and forth, and people might have gone back and forth. And so Abram is still very much in touch with what Lot is doing, even though there doesn't seem to be a close relationship there anymore. And so he makes this lengthy presentation. Again, we don't have time to read it, and it's going to be the last story we tell. He says, well, what if there's 50 people? And God says, well, if there's 50 people in the city that are good, that are righteous people, I'll spare the whole city. The good and the bad. I'll spare them all if there's just 50 good people. And then Abram thinks, the same as we would think, oh my word, what if there were only 49? Let's find out what kind of a God he really is. Well, But he doesn't say 49. And so he works his way down in increments. And he gets down to, what is it, 10 is the final number? I think 10 is the final number. He gets all the way down to 10. So by the time he's down at 10 people, we have to suspect he must be thinking about nothing but Lot and his immediate family. Lot and his wife. And there's two daughters that Lot has. And in addition to two daughters, there's two husbands-to-be that we read about in the story that he must be thinking about. So there's this close, immediate family. And so Abram sets to negotiate with God, hopefully to spare Lot's life one more time. Again, the blessing part. To his credit. Now, what would you and I feel like if we had been, in theory, betrayed or abandoned relationally by someone like that that we've helped out so often? Well, I know what I'd feel like. I'm not going to ask you what you'd feel like because you're probably all a lot more righteous than I am. By this point in his life, Abram is starting to understand the preciousness of life, the value of his call, and he really sees that. And he does intercede on behalf of that. And this is a powerful lesson. Let none of us forget this. We can intercede on behalf of people. We can make important petitions on behalf of people. Your voice matters to God. And this is part of this close, personal, we really do call it relationship. Not where we all get together and we say three or four sentences of joint prayer that all sound the same. But when you and your wife, you get together and you just petition God and you say, God, there's these people that I care about. There's this circumstance that I care about. And if I care about it, I know you care about it in some way. Is there something that we can do to change this situation? And I think I'm going to leave us with that story because it's a minute before 9 and we need to close at 9. And so maybe after the breakfast, the week after the breakfast, maybe we'll pick up with this. My hope was just that maybe if you looked at this guy's life a little bit, and we have a lot to cover in this man's life yet, that you take a little bit of encouragement in the fact that if your faith journey is slow in maturing, if there's a lot of ups and downs and sideways, or you're confused about God and about this walk that you're on, that you're in very good company. And it takes a long time to build a solid foundation.